everyone. Welcome to our inaugural episode of API Busters. This is Grace, and here is Phil. Say hi.
Hello. How are you doing?
Awesome. So today we're going to be giving everyone a sneak peek at sort of what we hope API Busters will be in our upcoming episodes, and also to delve into a couple things we've been doing and seeing at work. So first off, for introductions, Phil, if you'd like to start us off.
Yeah, my name is Phil Sturgeon, and I bang on about APIs all the time. I don't know, I feel like I've been working with APIs for a really long time, and like did a book about them, and I do conference talks about them. And whilst it's really not always the most exciting topic in the world, I think it's kind of an interesting new area that, you know, most backend programmers are kind of working on APIs now. So it's an interesting thing to learn about instead of just half-ass. I don't know, I figure whenever I'm not working on APIs, I'm usually out trying to kill myself on my bike. I had a pretty fun one. Did you see the one I posted on Slack today?
What happened to you?
So on Saturday, I was mountain biking up in Blue Mountain Reserve, just by Peekskill, here in New York, which is where I'm based. And it's my first time mountain biking in a really long time. I'm talking like 4 years. I used to do it quite a lot. But I, being a cocky arsehole that I am, was like, yeah, I can totally jump this massive log. And my back wheel kind of popped up and I went flying. I landed really hard on my front wheel, and the suspension kind of went all the way down. And instead of just kind of like leaning back and riding it out, I was just like, I currently have a broken collarbone still on my left, so I'm just going to throw my entire right body to the floor and like roll out of it. So
I'm trying to imagine all this happening, but I guess too long, didn't read.
Okay.
Did something on your bike and you got hurt.
Yeah, I went flying over the handlebars and did like an Action Man tumble roll, and I got a video of it in slow motion, so that was kind of fun.
That'll be good in your sort of action extras reel type of thing. I feel Absolutely. Like all NYC bikers should have one of those.
Yeah.
It'd be a good side career.
There's quite a few folks at WeWork that have been hit by cars, so yeah, that's definitely a thing.
Talk a little bit about that. If you guys didn't know, Phil and I, we actually met because we are co-workers at WeWork, and we used to be on the same team, but now Phil's working on some very interesting platform stuff, and I am working mainly on building out a robust access control system. So a little bit about me. I've been at WeWork for 2 years, and over the last year in particular, I've just done a lot of work regarding our company's integrations with various APIs and learned a lot about, you know, how to best structure applications when dealing with, you know, brittle third-party APIs, and also the various challenges that go into building an API that makes sense for your company. While, you know, making sure that it's flexible enough that a lot of different people can use it, and making sure that it's not impossible to upkeep, maintain, and also make better in the future. So yeah, it's been a really interesting and fun ride. In my free time, what do I do in my free time? Oh, I just got a pet snake.
And whoa, I had no idea you had a snake. That's really cool.
That's been highly stressful. I've been just trying to figure out how best to house my snake. Any podcast listeners that have snakes would love to hear input on this. But yeah, just completed my snake's first feed, which was very interesting. I should maybe have a separate snake podcast, because that's literally all I talk about nowadays with like everyone in my life, including my coworkers, just what's going on with my pet ball python, Oliver.
I love that it's called Oliver.
His name is Ollie.
Do you have the live mice, or is it kind of dead mice, or how?
Yeah. So the feeding part of it, not to like scare off any potential podcast listeners, trigger warning here, dead things that have to be heated up. I have to essentially thaw frozen mice for him to eat. And watching a ball python eat a mouse for the first time is pretty shocking. They are very, very aggressive when they feed. But yeah, that's sort of what I'm doing right now. Just hanging out with my snake.
That's very cool.
Things. Yeah.
I had roughly the same thing when I first got my turtle. I have a pet turtle called Stoford, named after Stoford Press, one of the writers in the UK. And yeah, he's a lot of fun to watch eat. I used to occasionally get kind of fish and stuff. And it's interesting to see how long some of them last. Some last months, other ones last seconds. But animals are, yeah, snakes and turtles are pretty fun pets, I reckon.
Yeah, and also this buddy is going to be with me for like 30 years.
Yeesh.
Very interesting. I'm excited to be like a 60-year-old person with a huge snake, because that's in the future.
For sure, yeah. Stoford's going to last another 20 years, which at the rate I'm having bike accidents is definitely much longer than me.
Yeah, I'm also like already thinking about like who am I going to, you know, bequeath my snake onto when I eventually leave this lovely planet. And I'm just hoping that if I do have children, they'll be like cool enough to like want to have the snake. But we'll see.
Yeah, you gotta hope so. It's not just you don't want them to just flush it afterwards and be like, thank God we finally got rid of this thing.
Yeah. Phil, do you want to be my snake godfather? Something happens to me, you'll take him on.
Yeah, I have my turtle guy. He's already sorted out.
Cool.
Anyway, speaking of random stuff that's nothing to do with APIs, so it was quite interesting. I invited you to kind of co-host this podcast with me, just because we were, you know, crushing API stuff at WeWork, and I knew it would be good to have you on. But then afterwards, I found out that you used to be involved with a radio show. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a college radio show. It was called Night Nurse. It was for about a year, I believe, and we played like the most random things. The music selection part of it was probably not as well thought out as it could have been. But my best friend Frank, he was my co-host on Night Nurse, played a lot of Scandinavian black metal. Which, very interesting to hear about all the weird shit that went down with those bands. And I just played all sorts of weird, random stuff as well. So it was a nice, lovely hodgepodge of random stuff. We did very, very scary sort of like train wrecky mixing for all of our tracks. Would have liked to have gotten better at that, but like, you know, don't really think that I made that much improvement over that 1 year. But we had a segment that we really liked to do. Our show was on Sundays, and we would just basically have all of our lady friends call in, just sort of like talk about stuff that they saw or experienced on their Saturday night out. And that was sort of like our most popular segment. It was like a very raunchy, sort of silly expose into the weird college dating life scene at Columbia. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I bet you got some stories from that.
Yeah, it was not as crazy as it could have been, but definitely very funny and very much enjoyed it.
Awesome. I'm curious about what sort of shit was going on with those bands. What sort of Scandinavian black metal are we talking? Because I'm well versed with Hammerfall and Dragon Force, but what sort of stuff?
Interesting. Well, I mean, there's just like a lot of like church burning. There's a lot of fans out there that love this kind of stuff, so I don't want to, you know, speak wrongly about this, but there's these bands that essentially did a lot of very controversial things like that. And there was also a bit of like murder in the scene. I really can't tell you all the details. I really don't remember everything off the top of my head. But yeah, that stuff happened. So church burning, murder stuff, black metal. Yeah.
And I'm back.
What happened?
Not entirely sure. What was the last thing I said?
I just like kind of started talking and then you never talked back.
Oh, okay. I think I replied and then stopped for a while. It's okay. We can edit things, so that's fine. I'm going to add a little timeline footnote.
Or we could keep this in.
Right? Yeah. Well, we'll eventually learn how to do it. What I was going to say about the, I was doing PHP Town Hall podcast for about 52 episodes. And before that, I did another podcast called Code Igniter something or other, probably Code Igniter Town Hall. And that was like 10 episodes or something. So I've kind of been doing podcasts for years, theoretically, and I'm still really bad at it. One thing I like about this new approach we're using with Zencastr is that theoretically we just both click record and then it just magics itself in. But before that was like a lot of do a Google Hangout and then download the MP3 and then slice out the audio, download the MP4 and slice out the audio and try and upload it to S3 and all this other shit. So I quite like that we don't have to do that much and I shouldn't lose an episode because I dropped wine on my laptop like happened before. But, we'll get the hang of it. We'll get going.
Okay, good. But anyways, to close off the segment about black metal stuff, just have to say, API Busters, we do not condone church burning or murder. But yeah, if you guys are interested in learning more about black metal, you guys can look up like Mayhem and Burzum and all of those dudes.
I'm glad that in our first episode we've already got the quote, we do not condone church burning. That's gonna have to be a little shout out in the on the homepage.
Hopefully this will be a every episode thing. I'm interested in not condoning a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, well, I never want to condone church burning, so we can just mention that on a regular basis anyway.
Yeah, no church burning this episode, guys, thank you.
So moving on to some stuff. So you mentioned that one of the struggles, one of the things we've worked on at WeWork was kind of integrating with like flaky third party services. And I don't know how you kind of want to jump into this one, but it's one of the more interesting problems I've ever worked with. Where basically every single month we had some fire to deal with. Right? How do you want to take it away?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to give everyone sort of like a overview about just sort of, you know, what flakiness kind of looked like in our world during this time, we were essentially trying to integrate with this third-party API, which had no logging on their end. So whenever something would go down, they actually had no idea to tell us what had happened. They also never really did any load testing. So as our user base grew and, you know, our API usage grew, when we would effectively run into performance problems, they had no way of telling us like, oh, actually, you know, you need to throttle your calls to this many calls per second. And thirdly, their error message handling and their responses oftentimes were not consistent across all the different endpoints. So just basically coming up with a consistent way of handling messages from all of their endpoints was very challenging. So one of the cool things that we actually did, and this is one of the things that Phil and I worked on, is we actually essentially helped them load test their API, which thinking about now is a totally ridiculous thing that we did, but we did do it. We wrote a whole bunch of scripts and basically helped them, figure out, okay, this is how many times we want to hit this API in a second in order for their system to not topple over. And we also implemented really serious logging on our end, and just basically made sure that every single API error we were getting from them, we were logging and we could easily access, and we could also easily query and like turn into nice graphs so that our stakeholders could see what's going on. And for the last bit, we did a full refactor of the last 2 months and essentially completely isolated our API integration with them to a layer that we can later on very easily rip out in case, you know, we'd like decide to switch to a different API provider. So a lot of really interesting lessons learned there. It also taught us how to, I think, build APIs a bit better internally. But yeah, it was a truly interesting set of conversations that was like, oh wait, you guys don't really have any logging going on? Okay, great. Then how do you guys know when something's not working well on your end? And the answer was kind of like, we don't really know if things aren't working well on our end. So
yeah. It was a bit mad with that third party service, right? The I think one of the main things that helped us out was whenever they'd enable logging, it would reduce the performance of their server, right? So like they'd turn on logging on production, and then things would be even slower than before. And then they'd say, oh, well, that was just because of the logging. And it was really hard to prove anything. And like their logging system was basically saying that their responses were perfect. Like they'd enable logging on production on a important day. And then they'd say, look, here are all the times, here's the upper and lower. None of them are more than 200 milliseconds or whatever. And we'd be like, no, this one took 30 seconds. We can tell because our process timed out. Like it cuts off after 30, so it must have taken a really long time. And it was just a backwards and forwards of like, yes, it's slow. And they're like, no, it's not. And we're like, yes, it is. And they're like, no, it's not. And it was really, really weird. So I think one of the more useful things that we did was to use Runscope. Shout out to Runscope. Those guys, cool.
Shout out.
We basically threw all of the traffic through the Runscope proxy so that instead of our servers making calls to the third party's servers, it would go through a Runscope proxy. And then when you do that, it basically records every single transaction, right? Like it adds like 50 milliseconds on top of the request, but it will say, you know, this request was made, it took this long, and this is the exact response that you got. And not only that, but you can then search through all of the requests for various different things, different status codes, different response times.
A lifesaver.
Yeah, you can create like a shareable link. So there was a few times when they said, no, not one of our requests is longer than 1 second. So I typed in response time greater than or equal to 10 seconds. And there was this whole page of responses that came up. So I sent some of the worst offenders to them. And they were like, oh, huh, interesting.
Yeah, and at one point they also thanked us, I remember.
Yeah,
for actually doing that.
And we helped them discover multiple bugs.
What to log, how best to log, and how best to load test their systems,
It was really weird because we helped them discover two things. We helped them discover that there were some kind of strange bugs in their general software that they were using for other vendors. But we also helped them discover that their logging system was slightly flawed in that it would time out after a certain amount of time and fail to record anything to do with that request. So basically, because they assumed that their requests would handle in less than a certain amount of time, like a couple of seconds, if any request went more than a couple of seconds, it would just ditch that thing because it assumed there was some other error in the logging system and just no record of that slow process would exist. So they were basically saying every single response that we know about is fast because we ignored all the slow ones.
So
that one really blew my mind.
Many frustrating experiences, but it's much better now. I'm, you know, truly very proud of like the work that we did, basically fixing all these issues and also raising all these issues to that third-party API service. And it just really goes to show, you know, this company, I don't think really treated their API as their as like a first-class product. They definitely, I think, thought of it more of just sort of like an add-on, like a nicety to have. But in this day and age, API integrations are just so important. I mean, half of the reason why we're able to automate, you know, very simple things at WeWork like access control is because we absolutely rely on APIs like this in order to make our business run much more smoothly and also, you know, a lot more cheaply. And coming into this, I think the people that built this API, you know, hadn't really thought of it being used in this way. So it was all sort of like news to them. But I'm very happy that we were able to sort of help them through this. And, you know, we're using it now and it's a lot better.
Yeah, I think one of the issues was that they kind of expected, they had this weird kind of multiple transaction approach where you would create sessions, right? They said they designed their API before REST was cool, and I never really knew what that meant, but they would basically require one request to log in, and then another request to do the thing, and then another request to log out, and because there were so many different buildings.
Every single one of their calls was basically not stateless. It was like, so it was very complicated because if we essentially had to preserve like the session ID from call to call within like a transaction, which like made things like much more complicated and difficult.
Yeah, and we're like passing it around the code in weird places, and like if there's an error and you fail to close out that session, then you like clogged up their server because there were too many open sessions, right? And that's really difficult. Like if you're making multiple requests to a server that's a little bit flaky and your timeout is hit, you know, like Heroku has a 30-second limit in the web thread. Obviously, it's better to not do that sort of stuff in the web thread for exactly this reason. But if you have to log in, do stuff, and then log out, and if you don't log out, that causes problems, then you're going to have a lot of problems because things can cut off and you can't log out. So stateless stuff is generally so much better. And whether you think REST is trendy or whatever, just having a single request that does a single thing is pretty much always the way to go. I think they've amended that with their new API, but they definitely defended that approach, and that approach is a bit weird.
Yeah. Interesting lesson learned, I think, on all the sides.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, we have a cool new system now. That was kind of an interesting one. Basically, there was kind of the old keycard system, and then there's, you know, the new one, Airlock. And it was a complete replacement, right? Like I think it was originally like a copy of the code base, and then you kind of started off tweaking it, and then it ended up being a massive refactor. So whilst there's this one system in production, and you have this other kind of brand new code base that you're trying to swap out, trying to maintain both of those at the same time must be really difficult. And how did you decide to kind of do that approach versus having a new version in the URL and changing some of the code? Like, How did all that come about?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was honestly quite challenging. There are a lot of different ways of doing the cutover sort of floated around. So, you know, one way we could have done it is we could have kept both the old and new versions up, and essentially had our other systems hit one and then have, you know, the data sort of like to either, you know, share a database for like a little while, have both systems reading from the same DB, or essentially have our apps talking to two systems at once, or having the data flow to one system and then to the second. But because the schemas were so different and the database schemas were so different, just basically, you know, the thought of having to maintain the data in these two different ways was a pretty big mind fuck in some ways. So we decided to do ourselves a favor and just do like a really clean cut over. And we spent a really long time thinking over, you know, how we could do this cut over in the sort of like fastest way possible, and also in the way that would make sure that the least amount of data was lost in that time. And yeah, I'm actually really happy with what we came up with. At the end of the day, when we released the new system, I think we were only down for about like 25 minutes or so. And we were able to capture all the data that was sort of lost in that time and just like, you know, port it into the new system. So it was a really, really simple cutover without any major sort of problems or anything.
Interesting. And how did you like convert the data across from one thing to a different thing?
Yeah, so we ended up writing this idempotent data migration script that essentially would just catch any data updates in the, you know, that you define from some like arbitrary time, and would just like basically translate it into the new schema. And so we ran that script for the majority of the data before the cutover. And then once the cutover finished, we just ran it for the data that was sort of lost in that 25 minute period when the new system was getting spun up.
Nice. That sounds pretty simple.
Yeah, it was better than I think we were trying to do it before, which you know, required like a whole suite of like RabbitMQ listeners to sort of like handle new data that was being created in like 8 different tables in the old system and like convert them to like 10 or 11 new data tables in the new.
I remember that actually. Very happy that the initial approach was like lots of active record, because we're mostly a Rails shop, right? So the initial approach, I think, was like a rake task with a bunch of kind of active record stuff. And it was like a 15-hour process. I remember you kind of saying like,
oh, yeah, many, I know I should use SQL, but
like doing it all in native SQL is so much faster, but it's so horrible to write.
Oh, God, horrible. Yeah. I've so done basically, those before. I mean, yes, the this whole like writing all the code for this new system actually didn't take that long. It probably took me and my teammate Wing probably like a month, maybe like 5-6 weeks to write everything and test everything. We also were really happy that we had the amount of test coverage that we ended up with, which was 100% for all the APIs. And overall, I think we were at like 75 to 80% test coverage over the entire application, which is really insane compared to all the other apps in New York's ecosystem. The data migration.
Going up, but it's not very high currently, is it?
Oh, no, it's definitely going up. We've been, I think, much, much better about it over the last 2 years. But I think this was one of the first systems that was introduced just, you know, right off the bat with that much test coverage, which I'm really happy about. But yes, API busters, we do not condone not writing tests. WeWork also loves writing tests. So, you know, don't take my word for it. But anyways, the data migration part, however, just like the various iterations that I went through, that actually took about like 2 to 3 weeks to like really figure out how we were going to do it. And the first iteration of it was pretty horrible, really horrible. Basically, used Active Record to map objects representing the old schema to objects representing the new schema. And it just took forever for honestly not very much data at all. And ultimately, it would have been like 15 hours to migrate all the data over, which would mean that, you know, you can't do it all in one workday, which is horrible because you're probably going to have to babysit it, you know, either before or after work, which is never fun. And secondly, if it at all, you know, poops out in the middle, if there is an error, it's going to be, you know, a 2 or 3 day process to, like, you know, fix all the data, get everything done, just because the initial run is just takes so, so long. So after, you know, sort of like giving up on that approach with the constraint that, like, it definitely needs to take a lot faster, we eventually wrote everything in SQL in a Rails project, which was not fun. And we ended up getting all the tables migrated in less than an hour. So it was awesome. Learned Sweet. A ton. Learned a ton about SQL. I what think, like biggest, many biggest other culture? Rails people, I definitely wasn't comfortable writing SQL in a Rails application, but it can be done. Yeah, sorry, what was that, Phil?
Sorry, what was the biggest gotcha you ran into writing, like, a massive block of SQL like that?
The biggest gotcha that we ran into? Like, the biggest thing that made the most... I think there were many things that I didn't know before I started this project. First of all, there are many ways to make data insertion idempotent. And one way that's really popular is an upsert, which is basically you update or you insert depending on some sort of, like, unique key. Usually it's something like the primary key or, like, maybe a UID on a record. But another way to do it is also, you know, if you're dealing with, like, really complicated joins, sometimes it's just better to, you know, delete any old records and just insert them anew when you see that they've been updated. So we used a couple different techniques to make sure that every single table could be migrated in an idempotent way, which was ultimately, you know, the big sort of, like, lifesaver when we actually cut the apps over.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds tough.
Yeah, it was interesting. But Phil, also, you've been working on some interesting things as well. And I know your latest sort of project at work has been this gem called WeCall. And can you sort of, like, talk us through, you know, why we needed that new gem and sort of the different benefits it brings?
Yeah, for sure. It's a gem that I'd love to open source eventually. I've only been working on it for a week or two, so it's not ready for prime time just yet. But it is running in production, and it hasn't exploded anything yet. So basically, WeCall is a gem which wraps Faraday, the kind of main, well, as far as I know, the number one popular HTTP client for the Ruby world. And the general idea is that I'm trying to create a gem that kind of holds your hand, is kind of the patronizing way of putting it, but I'm trying to think of a better way. Like, it's meant to be a gem that codifies a series of good ideas and trademark and conventions that can help with making HTTP calls be more reliable, easier to debug, and make kind of working in a service-oriented architecture a bit less of a madhouse. So one problem we've had in the past at WeWork is that one app, one service in the ecosystem will, for some reason, kind of start going a bit haywire, or like maybe a cache is bust and it starts to kind of stampeding herd on a different system. And it can actually end up taking that system down because we... just because of the way things are built. And so it can be a little tricky sometimes to work out which app is doing that. At the moment, kind of, you know, if an app is just calling another app and no one's kind of declared the user agent in Faraday, then all you're going to know about the web request that's being made is it will just literally say user agent Faraday 091 or whatever the version is. We've had situations where to debug which service is calling which service, we've actually looked at the specific version of Faraday and gone, oh, that's 082. There's only one app that uses 082. It must be that app. Right. And that's not a situation you want to be in. So people usually say, like, oh, you can just check the access tokens. Well, yeah, you can check the access tokens if that endpoint is something that's being restricted by access tokens. That's not always the case. So what I started to do, one of the first features, I ran around every single app, creating a config initializer, like a, you know, Rails config thing that basically configures a default header in Faraday and says, like, user agent is foo app. And then that was like my first attempt at fixing the problem. And that worked quite well. Although sometimes kind of New Relic will tell you which app is calling which app, they have that cool like map beta. It doesn't always work. So when clicking on that didn't work, people could go into the logging system and they could see which app was calling which app, and that helped. So that was the first thing I put into WeCall. If you try to initialize, instead of like initializing Faraday, you initialize a WeCall connection, which gives you a Faraday connection in return. But if you try to create one without giving it an app name and without giving it an environment name, so staging or production, then it will just shout at you. It'll be like, yo, who are we? What day is it? Who's the president? And it'll freak out and throw an exception. And so if you're using a Rails app, then it can just look at the Rails application name and kind of guess from that. But that was kind of the first thing I threw in there. And recently I've started doing a few more things. So I created a rack middleware that would log the user agent and the app name and the environment name. So both the callee side and the caller side now have that same convention. And I started working on timeouts. So you are forced, when you create a connection, you're forced to define a timeout. Faraday by default will just let it go for as long as you want. And that is not a good idea, because when we were calling that service that could take a minute, you're just sitting there for a minute waiting, and that's not helping anyone. So you're forced to think about your timeouts, and every single connection you make to a different service, if you have five different services in your code base, then you're going to have to work out a different timeout for each one. And although it's really annoying to do that, like when I was implementing this in one service, it started throwing exceptions saying I didn't have a timeout, and I thought, oh, I've got to go and look at all the times. So I was annoyed by my own feature, but it was really helpful. Like I started looking through New Relic and I was looking at all the calls that class was going to make, and I found out what the slowest was. And not only did I find that some were way slower than they should have been, so it was good that I looked at that New Relic report, but it gave me a good idea of kind of what services were responding in what times, and so I could set a useful timeout for those services. So that's kind of the stuff that WeCall is going to be working on, like helping people avoid mistakes or at least make them easier to monitor, log, and debug so that they can fix them when they do happen.
Yeah, I honestly would... This is just giving me all sorts of lovely inspiration right now, but you know, it'd be great if we also built an application that is essentially just sort of like a API layer that abstracts out all the different APIs that we've built over the course of the last like 4 years, just because we really do have so many of them. A lot of them are also versioned in sort of wonky, interesting ways. And just to have, you know, some sort of like API application that can essentially, you know, create sort of consistent like API abstractions for all the different APIs. That would be really great. And I think the WeCall gem that you built would be a very, very useful tool in building that as well.
Potentially. I mean, That could be a very interesting thing. What this is quite low level. So it's, if Faraday is the lowest, like bare bones, like down to the wire, like I'm going to make a HTTP call, then WeCall is like kind of putting a bit of fluff on top. But absolutely, like to make like, I'm, as part of the platform team, I'm starting to try and push towards using JSON schema and kind of API blueprint type stuff, maybe RAML, maybe API blueprint, but API specifications in general. And that's a topic I really want to talk about more in later episodes.
Yeah.
But absolutely. If we start using API specifications, then we can very easily, we can automate a lot of code, and you can build like SDK implementations out of the API specifications. So if there was some way of combining those things, then that would absolutely be pretty cool. Like you can have the SDK built from the API specification, and then that sits around the WeCall gem. That's the part that's making the actual requests. Yeah. Then that's a whole bunch of good conventions with very little actual work being done by the developer on a daily basis, you know?
Yeah, because the thing with APIs, it's like once you sort of hit on how you would like, you know, your APIs to generally behave and whatnot, it really is, you know, so much tech debt you have to go through to basically rewrite your old APIs in the image of what you would like them now to be. So building out some sort of application that can essentially build, you know, a best practices layer almost on top of everything that we have now might be really awesome. Could solve a lot of problems.
For sure. The other approach that people are talking about a lot, and this is being thrown around at WeWork, and I'm sure it's being thrown around at every other engineering company ever, or company with engineers, but people are considering GraphQL for exactly this. So what's GraphQL is the latest, hottest thing in some people's eyes, and I've written a bunch of articles about kind of, it's great, but calm down.
Time to plug your latest series of GraphQL blog posts.
I'm straight. I'll put a footnote in the timeline. So whilst GraphQL is awesome, like I don't necessarily think you want to go, you know, changing every single REST API to GraphQL for the sake of it, but GraphQL is totally awesome at this sort of thing. So some smarter people than myself at WeWork have been talking about having a kind of a generic GraphQL API, you know, like just the one API, which then proxies out requests to other services. So you can have all these, like, this is an RPC API endpoint, and this is a REST API, and this is some other random shit that we don't know what happened there. The person was tired and stuck. But like, you can have all these random things, and just that one GraphQL API knows about all the different kind of standards, but then the client can just call the one GraphQL API, and there's a lot of work involved there. But if you think about it, it's not that much work more than the different clients are doing. If you have one iOS app that has to talk to 10 different services, right, and it has to know about the authentication system for service A and B, which is different to C, and it has to know the error format, and then service D uses JSON API, but then another service uses something else. Like, each client has to know so much stuff. And then you have the Android client that has to know the same amount of stuff. And then the web app has the similar problems. And yes, you get into these like weird differences where one client implements things in a slightly different way. So theoretically, if we could kind of bung a GraphQL API in front of that, and then these other services can, you know, just call the GraphQL API, it could save a lot of trouble for them.
Indeed. I agree. I really do. And I hope for everyone that's sort of tuning in, you know, I really hope that this can be a place where we can talk about the different challenges that we're seeing at work. But, you know, as always, these are real working challenges that we're facing. And in no way do I want to cast any sort of like judgment on our forefathers in the WeWork engineering department. Definitely everything's a work in progress, and I'm really proud of the stuff that we've been working on recently. But yeah, always room for improvement.
Damn right. The general rule with all programming is if you still like the work you did 3 months ago, you haven't learned enough. And in the world of APIs, that stuff is really prevalent. Like, I kind of look back at some of the stuff I was writing, some of the code and some of the suggestions and recommendations I was making kind of a year ago, and I'm like, oh, don't know why I thought that was a good idea. So we're all consistently learning and improving and trying to make things better. But we just need to
sort of like sweat drops you feel when someone at channels in your team's Slack channel is like, who wrote this line of code? And you're just like, that would definitely be me.
And thanks to GitBlame, whenever I see like an engineer that I haven't really spoke to in a while kind of pop up and they're like, hey, Phil, got a quick question. I'm like, that's going to be a GitBlame conversation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm always pleasantly surprised when it's not and they just want to talk about things. But
just DB me. That's my new model.
Sweet. And that is 45 minutes on the dot. That's all from us this time. Thank you for listening to the first episode of API Busters. And don't forget to subscribe. Go to apibusters.com or go to iTunes and search API Busters so you can subscribe and find out all about new episodes as they pop up. Thank you very much.